Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The popular protests in Iran and the political intrigue that lurks behind them have riveted the world. What Iran looks like once the dust settles may have a giant effect on the future of regimes and societies, war and peace across the whole Middle East. This hour, On Point, Iran's uncertain future and the ripple effects of people power from the Mideast to Washington. You can join the conversation. Do you think this display of people power will be viral? Will we be seeing street politics play out in Cairo, Damascus, Jeddah? And what does it mean for the U.S.? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now to discuss how the unrest in Iran may ultimately affect the U.S. and the Middle East, I'm joined from Beirut, Lebanon, by Rami Khoury. He's director of the Issam Fares Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University in Beirut. And then he's also editor-at-large of The Daily Star, a Lebanese English language daily. Rami, welcome back.
Thank you, Jack. Glad to be with you.
Pleasure to have you. And from Arlington, Virginia, we're joined by Anthony Cordesman. He holds the Arleigh E. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Mr. Cordesman, thank you for coming on Point.
A pleasure, Jack.
Rami, let's start with you. In one of your recent columns, you write provocatively that whatever happens in the Middle East, whatever happens in Iran, you say whatever happens in Iran will largely be perceived negatively by the majority in our region. Can you explain that?
Well, yes. I mean, there's always exceptions, but broadly speaking, I would say if you're looking at the Arab regimes or if you're looking at the Arab people and public opinion, and those are two very different things because in most countries they're quite separate. But in both cases, they're watching Iran with a lot of concern, but also with a lot of sort of docility, and they're watching Iran as something they watch on television. The regimes in the Arab world mostly don't like Iran, with a few exceptions like Syria and others, but mm-hmm. most of the Arab regimes don't like what's going on, don't like the Iranian regime. They'd be happy to see the Iranian regime overthrown, because many of them, you know, they fear it. They think it's hegemonic and it threatens them, etc. But at the same time, the Arab regimes don't want the Iranian regime to be overthrown by street demonstrations, mm-hmm. because they know very well that their turn could be next. So it's a lose-lose situation for the Arab regime. If the Iranian regime stays, they don't like it. If it's overthrown, they don't like it. Mm-hmm. Same for the Arab people. Arab people, broadly speaking, I would say, the majority, well over half, like what the Iranian regime is doing and standing up to the U.S., defying the U.N., bad-mouthing the Israelis, etc., etc. Broadly speaking, I would say a majority of Arabs like what the Iranians are doing. They don't particularly want to live in that kind of system, but they cheer them on because the Iranians confront the Americans and the Israelis. But at the same time, many people, and most people in the Arab world, are jealous of the Iranians who are agitating and rising up and trying to change their regime, or at least change the way that the regime functions. So the people of the Arab world are also, they're not happy if the Iranian regime changes. But they're also unsatisfied because they see Iranians agitating and the Arabs are very docile and passive, and it accentuates for them in the Arab world their own passivity and docility and powerlessness. So it's a very bad situation in terms of the Arab regime and the Arab people looking at what's going on in Iran, and it really shows the depth of the incompetence and mediocrity of the modern Arab political system, which is almost totally bankrupt, and you see it no better than in what's going on right now.
So in civil society, in these regimes, there is no opposition that's looking at this and saying that's what we want in our country?
Well, you have a lot of people in the Arab world who would like to have demonstrations and would like to change their regimes in the Arab world or change their policies of their regimes, have more equitable, more dynamic, more prosperous, more democratic societies, etc. Sure, there's a lot of activism, but nowhere has it had a breakthrough. We don't have a single really democratic Arab country. we have lots of elections, we have lots of parliaments, we have lots of political parties, but none of them have any significant credibility whatsoever. So again, this is the second time in a generation that the Iranian people have agitated against their own regime. Once it was against the Shah, now it's against the Islamic government. And the Arabs are still watching it on TV. The only difference now is they watch it in Arabic on Jazeera, whereas before they could only watch it on foreign TVs in English.
Mm. Anthony Quartersman, in Washington, you outlined two scenarios for the United States, one if the leadership does change and one if it doesn't. You sort of think through options. Let's take what you say, and probably and undoubtedly correctly, is the less likely alternative if the regime does not if the regime does change. How should the United States respond?
Well, first, very carefully. I think there is a confusion here that because you have popular uprisings, you have some idea you know what it means if they succeed. This is a popular uprising which protests economic conditions and repressive social conditions. Mm-hmm. No one has talked about foreign policy, security issues, the things which concern people most in terms of Iran's actions outside Iran. It also is a protest, in effect, in support of a candidate who was chosen because he is part of the current power structure and the current power elite. So you have a popular uprising on the one hand with no clear goals, just a set of protests in support of someone involved in a completely different power struggle whose personal goals and objectives aren't known. You're also talking about a struggle, at least at present, focused on the presidency, mm-hmm. which in Iran is a power position that has no control over the media, the security services, the military, the justice system, or any other instrument of power. And while it may threaten the supreme leader, that isn't clear yet. So people here are looking at this, I think, sometimes from the perspective of what happened in East Germany when the wall came down. But that is not what's happening in Iran.
And even if the opposition were to triumph here, improbably, we would still have the same issues vis-a-vis Iran. The issues of their nuclear capability.
The most important point here is there is no opposition.
Mm.
There is a broad-based set of popular protests, which is not in support of a candidate or figure with any announced program or goals. And if they do bring down Ahmadinejad, it isn't clear they bring down the supreme leader.
Right.
And if they do bring Mousavi to power, no one knows what that means, and the people protesting have not set any goals. You need to remember, as Rami pointed out earlier, that the regime or revolution that brought the Shah down was a middle-class protest, which was hijacked effectively by a charismatic religious figure who spent more than a year involved in a bloody civil conflict with another extremist group called the Mujahideen-e-Khalq.
Mm-hmm.
It never brought something to power or someone to power that had popular support when the revolution began.
Mm-hmm. And your second scenario, briefly, if the regime does not change, how should we react in that event, in the event that we have the same president, this time morally discredited before the world? How does that affect our relations with Iran?
Well, I think when you talk about reaction, we need to be very, very careful not to have the U.S. try to take the lead in exposing what is going on there. It's far better if it is the media outside the U.S., if it's institutes outside the U.S., Chatham House, which is the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London, has already done a very good study. In spite of the problems with governments Rami outlined, you do have some very serious Arab research centers. You have Arab media, which have been very critical of what's happened inside Iran. will be much better off if we inform them, make sure they have the best possible picture of what we know, but let them take the lead.
How does that sound to you, Rami?
Yeah, as usual, what Anthony Portisman says, I agree with, because it's very rational and based on facts and reality, rather than, as we often hear around the world talking about the Middle East, people just kind of fantasizing. But what he's saying is absolutely correct. The situation in Iran, actually, you said there's an opposition. There's actually three elements here. You've got the ruling power elite headed by the President Khamenei, the supreme leader, and then the president is part of that. And then you have the reformists who are important in the government, and they are challenging the election. And then you have the popular uprising on the street. So you really have three different elements here. And other than what the government wants, what Ahmadinejad and Khamenei and their group and the, you know, the military that they control, what they want. The other two, we don't really know what they want. These are people who are protesting against what they know they are against. They're against rigging election. They're against being treated like idiots by their own government. They're against being abused by their own people. But they haven't laid out a policy program.
Yes.
These are not people who are, you know, in an election and saying, well, here's what we want if we change the ISIS.
Right.
So this is a dynamic that is going to take a long time. But I think that there's been a critical, the critical element here is that you have had people clearly in large numbers challenging the established order and the president and the ruling elite and the supreme leader almost by name.
This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're trying to figure out how the events in Iran could change the Middle East and America's policies there. My guests this hour are Anthony Cordesman in Arlington, Virginia. He holds the Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And in Beirut, Rami Khoury, who is the editor-at-large of the Daily Star, a Lebanese English-language daily. Gentlemen, let's hear from our callers, if we might. Mark is calling from Acton. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I wanted to speak about the impact on American policy, and it seems to me that unless there is some perceived weakening of the Ahmadinejad regime, that is to say, some kind of either a change or, short of that, some sort of accommodation in a big way, I think that it's going to be much harder for the president to embark on a diplomatic program with Iran, and I think that that really is the motivation behind the criticism you're hearing from a lot of those on the right, McCain, Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham called the president weak and timid, which is just amazing to me, and they're trying to take diplomacy off the table. And my concern is that unless Ahmadinejad is forced to make some accommodation, or the Grand Ayatollah is forced to make some kind of accommodation, that will be the fallout in domestic politics. And I'd be interested in the comments as to whether there's anything Obama is going to be able to do to push that agenda if Ahmadinejad is perceived as not having been weakened.
Thank you for that. Anthony Cordesman, what's your reaction to that question?
Well, I think it's a very good question. I think we need to be very careful, though. I don't think there was ever much chance there was going to be any sudden breakthrough in diplomacy. Yes, we'd like Iran to change its attitudes towards Israel and the Arab-Israeli peace process. We'd like it to stop its ties to Hezbollah and Hamas. We'd like to see an end to the constant buildup of irregular warfare capabilities in the Gulf, an end to the nuclear program, and a host of other measures. But these were not issues anyone was debating in Iranian politics. And they were not issues that it was ever clear that establishing diplomatic relations were going to rapidly change. What may still be possible and what would still be desirable is any kind of embassy or interest section does help the United States gather information. It does serve as a means for cultural exchanges, for lower-level progress. There may still be the possibility of very carefully targeted and managed negotiations over Afghanistan or Iraq or drugs. But even though it may be harder and even though people are calling for no sort of talks, the fact is the advantage of diplomacy is not that you change the world, but you understand your opponent better. And these smaller negotiations may over, say, 6 to 9 months, if they're possible at all, still be possible.
Now, on the nuclear front, Anthony, there was some speculation just a couple of weeks ago that where we were headed was toward Iran essentially in the position of Japan and Germany. That is, having completed the fuel cycle with nuclear enrichment and being right on the cusp of being able to weaponize that, but stopping at that point, and that would be an acceptable outcome for the United States, and that from speculation I had seen, it looked as if that were a possibility even in Iran. First of all, did you read that as well? And second, what do you think the prospects for that sort of settlement are?
Well, as you say, it is speculation, and a lot of it is wishful thinking, not because it necessarily won't happen, but because there's absolutely no evidence as to what Iranian intentions are. And these are held at an extremely sensitive level within the leadership. What you have is a host of people guessing. The problem that you also get into is that there are many experts who feel that if Iran is going to proliferate, it will build up a large stockpile of low-enriched material and then disperse it after it has the ability to use centrifuges outside these central facilities to create enough weapons so it can't be preempted by Israel or the United States. Will that happen? Who knows? The people who talk about the sort of bomb in the basement, this sort of capability you haven't tested, generally have more, I suspect, political science than technical background. To actually make a working weapon, you have to go through a very advanced process of simulation at a minimum. The countries which have set off weapons recently have not had successes, at least the first time around. And this is India, Pakistan, and North Korea. So testing becomes a critical aspect of this. People who have the kind of explanations you've talked about also ignore the fact that Iran's major investment is in long-range ballistic missiles. And these missiles, basically, are little more than pointless terror weapons unless they have a warhead, which is either chemical, biological, or nuclear, and in practice it almost has to be nuclear or biological. Now, these are realities that are going to play out over a decade or more. They almost inevitably are going to produce Israeli and other regional reactions. So when people talk about these bargains or speculate, as you pointed out, the only word that really matters is speculate.
Rami, a question from you, from Saeed. Welcome to On Point.
Hey, Jack, how's it going? Thank you so much. I just wanted to sort of add to what one of your guests were saying. I've lived in the Gulf 25 years, and then I moved to the U.S. So there really is no opposition there. I mean, most of the people who get selected, and I'm using the word selected, to the legislative councils are literally selected. So, I mean, if you've got one autocrat, you know, however good or bad he or she may be, and they're selecting people, so there really is no opposition. So that was my first comment, I guess. Another question, I guess, question that I would sort of pose to Anthony Cordesman and Rami Khoury especially, is if you look at the example of, say, Kuwait or Egypt, where you've had some sort of elections there, but the political process or the process basically breaks down because either the governments don't work or because they're not let to, you know, they're not allowed to work by the government or the incumbent itself. How do you see those things out in the broader Middle East, vis-a-vis the things that are happening in Iran?
Rami, do you want to try that first?
Yeah, sure. You've had
about 30, 40 years now of activism and dynamism in different Middle Eastern countries in different periods, and all kinds of attempts by people in civil society, in parliament, in political parties, in the media, personal contacts. Many, many people all over this region have tried to achieve what only Turkey has achieved in the Islamic Middle East, which is a reasonably credible, accountable, and stable political system based on democratic elections and checks and balances. The reality is that power in the Middle East is not exercised through the formal institutions of state. So political parties, parliaments, elections are not really serious events. The real power is negotiated quietly, privately, through various tribal groups, the military forces, the security forces, the royal families, and major business groups. Those are the five critical players in the Arab world. And we've seen this for many, many years. Muslim Brotherhood and Islamist groups are the biggest ones because they're the ones that are most difficult for the governments to outlaw or to defeat, because Islam is the indigenous dominant religion. So there's still a real problem in the Arab world in terms of not just getting good government systems. You have a deeper problem in most Arab countries, not all of them, but most of them have a deeper problem, which is the configuration of statehood is not always sensible or satisfying or even legitimate to many of its own citizens. So we've got, you know, there's a reason why the Arab world is the only region in the entire world that is chronically, almost chromosomally non-democratic as an entire region. There isn't a single real democratic country in the Arab world.
Partly because they don't even want to define the polity. They don't even want to define the borders too tightly.
Well, because the power is exercised through military and intelligence and security-based regimes that are largely supported by Western powers and have been for 40 or 50 years. And this is it's very difficult to change these political power systems. There hasn't been a popular revolution like Iran, like the Marcos in the Philippines, like Indonesia, like the Ukraine. We haven't had a popular uprising that changed an Arab government in the modern Arab world. All the changes have been through coups, army colonels taking over from other army colonels. The power structure is so tightly controlled, it's very difficult to break through it. It will happen. There will be a breakthrough. One day we will get a Mandela or a Nekvalesa or a Gorbachev. Somebody will come along who will, and maybe we will see it soon after this second Iranian uprising. We don't know. You can't predict how it's going to happen, but there will be an orderly transition to more sensible government in the Arab countries. It hasn't happened yet, though.
Anthony Cordesman, could we help that? I mean, as Rami said, for reasons of our foreign policy, we have propped the regimes up. Ought we not to leverage our aid, condition our aid, say, to Egypt on changes in opening up Egypt? Is that too much of a risk for us to run now that the Cold War is over, now that Egypt has a peace with Israel? I mean, have we not neglected that whole front?
I think, frankly, that what you're describing is a fantasy. The fact is that if the societies themselves are not going to push for these change at a broad popular level and do so with some effectiveness, the regime may be reluctant to give up U.S. aid. It may take cosmetic steps or half measures, but it isn't going to change the basic problems that Rami outlined. The other great difficulty here is the confusion as to how election orders take place with the quality of governance. The greatest problem in the Arab world is not simply how governments are chosen. It is how often they simply can't govern well and don't govern to the benefit of the people or move toward development. But I also have to say that it isn't just the Arab world. If you look down a list of the countries which claim to have a president, at least two-thirds of them have effectively a dictator or an authoritarian regime. Iran is not a democracy. You allowed four candidates to run out of hundreds who applied. You can't run for the majlis unless you're selected. The president is basically a figurehead compared to the supreme leader, and there are at least three bodies which can checkmate any of the people who are elected, even under this repressive system. So when we talk about the problems in the Arab world, I think perhaps a slightly broader perspective is needed, and particularly one's needed in regard to Iran, because there's another message we haven't touched on. That is, this regime is now discredited, along with the concept of the supreme leader. Khomeini could stand aside. He had the status. Khamenei doesn't. Is there anyone in Iraq, are there any Shiites outside Iran that are now going to buy the idea that this repressive supreme leader somehow is a legitimate voice for the entire Shiite faith, much less Islam? I think that is perhaps one of the most critical impacts of what's happening.
Frenzy is calling from Montreal, Canada. Hello, welcome.
Hi. My question is that, are we blew it out of proportion? Because what I've seen now in Iran, I see people protest in Tehran, but I don't see protests in other cities of Iran. I'm just wondering if we're not taking our, a protest like a fantasy, because I don't think people are so dissatisfied with the regime yet.
Rami, have you seen protests elsewhere in Iran?
Well, one of the problems is that news coverage has been severely restricted by the Iranian government, so we don't have a fully accurate picture. But I think there's enough news coming out, and certainly from credible sources and people calling each other, and we're getting information that there is a protest that is really across most of the country. It's unlikely to overthrow the regime, obviously, in the short run, I think. But the significant thing is that a red line has been crossed, that people have gone out on the streets and publicly disobeyed the supreme leader. I mean, if Ayatollah Khomeini was there, this would never have happened. But with Khamenei, he came out publicly and said the election is fine and everybody go home. And the next day they came out, and the day after that people came out and challenged him. So a critical point has been crossed. So it's not, you don't measure this by the number of people in the street. You measure it by the audacity of those people who are on the street, because they are the cutting edge of the protesters. In the United States, I remember in the late 60s when I was at college, the protests against the Vietnam War, there was only a couple hundred thousand people who were out in the streets in the United States, but those represented millions and tens of millions who were against the war. So you don't count heads. What you do is you measure the intensity of what's in their heart and the courage they're showing by going out there and risking their lives, and some of them have lost their lives. So this is powerful. When this happens, it means that this is like the tip of an iceberg. And when you challenge these powerful regimes, and this is a very powerful regime that will use its force, when people are stop losing their fear of their regime, then that means this is probably the beginning of a new historical phase.
I think we need to be very careful here first. All we've seen from Twitter, from TV coverage, all of the outside analysis indicates there are national protests. They're also limited. They have been brought under control in a lot of areas. There have been systematic selective arrests, which you can't see on television and haven't been picked up by the media, which do a great deal to remove the leadership of these protests. But on the other hand, this regime has had to admit that in 50 Iranian cities, more people voted than registered.
Yes.
And in a lot of these cities, it was quite clear Ahmadinejad was unpopular. You've also seen evidence that the real total may be about 150 to 200 urban areas in Iran.
Indeed.
That's pretty national.
This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're trying to get into the minds of policymakers in the White House, the Pentagon, and the State Department as they try to predict where the Iran crisis is headed and what it could mean for everything from America's wars in Afghanistan and Iraq to its olive branch to the Iranian regime, nuclear proliferation, the peace process, and more. We're talking to Anthony Cordesman in Arlington, Virginia, a senior analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and to Rami Kori in Beirut, editor-at-large of the Daily Star, a Lebanese English-language daily. Let's take some calls. Davis from Austin, Texas, welcome to On Point.
Hi, gentlemen. I hope you all are doing well. My question is, Iran as a state, I assume, gets a ton of money from oil revenues. So my question is, these individuals that are protesting, are they protesting as taxpayers from a self-sufficient economy in the sense that there is a domestically self-sufficient economy, or are they protesting as for in the name of free speech? Because, well, I guess what I'm asking again is are they paying any taxes as individuals that are operating in an economy where they don't require licenses from the state for everything? Or does the state control everything, and they're basically they're just trying to get a share of the oil revenues? And I'll take my my question off the air.
Rami, how about the economic factor in this protest?
Well, I tell you, I've been in the Middle East for the last 40 years of my adult life, watching these various kinds of protests happen. And I remember in the early 70s, mid-70s, when you had the rise of the Islamist movements, the Muslim Brotherhood movements, and I mean this latest phase of these Islamist movements, what you had was a combination of economic stress and political indignity together. And it's very important to understand the balance between those two. It's not just one thing that drives people to go out in the streets. It's a combination of their humanity and their dignity being degraded to the point where they're fed up with it, but also economic stress and pressures in the sense that mm-hmm. they can't take care of their kids, or their kids are not going to have a reasonable chance at a decent life. And it's the combination of those two that pushes people to go out into the streets and risk being killed or imprisoned. And I think that's the situation. And the tax issue, I don't know Iran internally and the economic situation, but I do know that around the region I've studied, most governments don't have the political legitimacy or the technical skills to tax their own people's income. And that's why most governments rely on trade to the duties and tariffs and value-added tax on sales. Income tax is, it's very hard to collect income tax from individuals, and most people in the Arab region don't pay much. And most governments still only get around maybe 10% of their income from income tax, as opposed to the Western world where it's much higher. So this is, again, back to the issue of the political configuration and the legitimacy and the efficacy of these countries. Iran, though, is a country that has much more national legitimacy and credibility and bulk than most of the Arab countries, like Egypt, like Turkey. Mm-hmm. It is a big, strong, really solid, anchored country. But it still has economic stress, and it's a political and economic stress together that drives people to do what they're doing.
Yeah. Abdi is calling from Cambridge, Mass. Hello.
Hi, Jack. I enjoy your comments on the air for years.
Thank you.
I like to exert my opinion in this program, and that is that I did vote for Mousavi here in Boston, and a couple of Plaza Hotel, I think it was. And I am, in general, for separation of state and church. I think the Iran situation and even Pakistan, everything else, it's fallen victim for Arab-Israeli conflict. And if it wasn't for that, Iran would have been a secular government right now. So, but Iran is the barometer for American policy in the world, really. And in order for U.S., it's the U.S. problem, too. In order for U.S. to find out what its policy would be, it has to correspond its the result, what's happening in the Middle East. In the same time, I agree with Obama's policy of being indifferent quite a while, let the things get take it spin. And also I believe in the evolution of Iranian politics towards secularism, and we should support progressive movements like I would consider Mousavi is more progressive than mm-hmm. the other leaders.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you for that, Abdi. Rami, what about the Arab-Israeli issue affecting the Iran situation? Abdi seems to think that the standoff in the Middle East has paralyzed the evolution of a more secular, toward a more secular society in Iran. I'm not sure how exactly, but what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think when you talk about Iran and Israel, one of the important things that people need to remember is that 30 years ago, the Israelis and the Iranian Shah were extremely close, and they were cooperating on security and on intelligence and all kinds of things. So this Iranian-Israeli tension is very much a consequence of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and really a populist demagogic policy by Ahmadinejad and his people, who play on this because they know that it resonates well in the Arab world, and if they criticize the Israelis and criticize the Americans, that this will resonate well. And Iran wants to build up support and friends all over the Arab world, other than Hezbollah and one or two others that are mm-hmm. structurally linked to the seat of power in the supreme leader's office and supreme leader's personality in Iran. So the Israeli-Iranian relationship goes up and down. It's vastly exaggerated in the United States as almost everything having to do with Israel is in the United States, unfortunately. But the reality is that Iranians are not stupid. They're certainly never going to attack Israel because they would get pretty much wiped out themselves. They know that. But they use Israel as a way to generate support. It doesn't work very well, actually, because most Iranians, public opinion in Iran is critical of Israel at one level, but they think that Ahmadinejad is wasting a lot of time mm-hmm. doing what he's doing. He should focus on domestic issues.
Right.
So I think we shouldn't exaggerate it and look at the core issues that are much more important.
Anthony Cordesman, how about the view from Tel Aviv now at what's going on? I mean, Prime Minister Netanyahu was on Meet the Press on Sunday, making a strong statement about the threat posed by this regime and by the nuclear capability. How do you and there's been a sense in Washington, in fact, it's been stated that, you know, Israel is willing to give Iran about a year before it considers acting unilaterally even against these nuclear sites. What's your sense of that?
I don't think we need to be very careful about rhetoric. The unfortunate reality is that Israel and Iran sometimes find it convenient to exploit each other. Israel can point to this existential threat as the focus and in some ways avoid the more unpleasant issues like settlements and the peace process. Iran can use Israel as the target. It explains why it can expand its influence inside Lebanon, why it can support Hamas. It explains the ties to Syria. It can justify things like its nuclear program and its missile program. But in focus, as Rami points out, where is Iran's real target? It's the Arab states in the Gulf. It's its neighbors. It's expanding Iranian power. Now, when it comes down to deadlines and time estimates on nuclear weapons, there's been a difference between the United States and Israel for more than a decade. Israeli politicians and sometimes Israeli intelligence officials keep coming up with the idea of the sudden bomb. Mm-hmm. They don't explain how they're going to have a functioning deliverable weapon and often basically skate over the fact that at most they're talking a nuclear explosion, not a deliverable weapon. So the politics of this, unfortunately, in some ways, are the politics of mutual convenience mm-hmm. between Israel and Iran. They both can demonize each other.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Rebecca is calling from Des Moines. Rebecca, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Yes. I just like to say that I agree with Barack Obama's approach to this. I don't think we can afford to be the scapegoats in this situation. And we will be used as a scapegoat if we stick our stick our nose into this situation. I think we need to let them sort it out, and I think Barack Obama is doing exactly the right thing.
Rebecca, thank you for that. Let's get another one from Michael in Beaufort, North Carolina. Michael, welcome.
Hi, Jack. I was wondering, maybe with all upheavals of this kind, the country is basically just dependent on its own, you know, everything has to be played out within the borders. But Iran is it seems to me unique in that it's not really Arab, it's Muslim, but it's Persian, and I think ethnically it has a totally different history and even a sense of relationship to the Arab world. And it's not Western, certainly. So I was just wondering whether this is just to be played out internally or whether there's any any voice anywhere in the region or in the world that can have influence, Russia, China, or anybody, or is it a matter of everybody just watching this and letting it play out?
Rami, what's your sense of that?
Well, Iran has state-to-state relations with many of the big powers around it, Iraq, Turkey, Syria, the Russians, the Chinese. You have significant investments from the Chinese and others in energy and other fields in Iran. So there are many partners that Iran has that can engage it and talk to it. But if there's one single overriding sentiment in Iran, I would say it is resistance to foreign, not only just foreign meddling, but even foreigners coming and telling them, giving them good, friendly advice. They just don't take to that very well. So I think there's not a lot that foreign partners can do other than just to treat Iran as a normal country, to engage it, to deal with it as you deal with any other country. You make deals. I mean, the critical point with the Iranians is, and with all people in this region, you know, Hillary Clinton and others, you often use the phrase, we want to have a conversation. Well, in this part of the world, in the Middle East, we don't do conversations. We do negotiations and have done so for 7,000 years, ever since we've had settled cities and small empires and city-states. People negotiate relationships with one another, and a negotiation has to be mutually beneficial. And people need to negotiate with the Iranians and with the Syrians and with the Israelis, the Turks, everybody. And if people were to deal with Iran on that level, I think you would find a much more realistic outcome, like the U.S. negotiated with the Soviet Union to do the Helsinki Pact, and look what happened 20 years later. So I think people need to just stop looking at these countries as strange, unusual beasts and deal with them as the people deal with every other country, negotiate relationships, come up with a win-win situation, compromises on both sides, and security for both sides.
Rebecca raised the question of President Obama and how he's responded. Has there been an Obama effect in this protest? Or is that just myopic American solipsism?
Jump in first, Rami, here. I would say, you know, the interesting thing about the Obama effect is that the Obama effect is actually an Obama response, I think. People have talked a lot about, well, Obama has taken these initiatives and it has had an impact all over the Middle East. I think it's the other way around. It's the fact that so many people in this region, governments and movements and people, including the Iranians, resisted and challenged the U.S. for the last 10, 15 years. And Obama understood that the U.S. policy wasn't working and the U.S. was losing ground. And therefore, Obama is the one who changed, came up with a much more sensible, rational policy, and therefore is getting good vibes in return. I think the lesson is if the Americans change, people in the Middle East change, and they connect together, there's much more likely to be movement forward. And it's really the Netanyahu-led Israeli government that is very much the odd man out now. The Iranian government and the Netanyahu government are the two sort of most extreme groups in the Middle East, while the rest of the people are trying to figure out how do you connect, including Hamas is talking about how do we, you know, negotiate a settlement of the Arab-Israeli conflict and things like that. So, yes, there is an Obama effect, but the Obama effect is partly reflecting that the U.S. changed its policy in a sensible, humble way and should be applauded for doing so. And in return, it is reaping some benefits, I think.
What is your opinion of that, Anthony?
I think we need to be very careful. We're generalizing, I think, far too much. And we talk about the Arab world I have to say, every time I hear about the Arab world or the Arab solidarity, it's a little like hearing about Europe. You're talking still about divided and very different cases. And the Obama effect in Iran, this has grown up out of Iranian politics, out of Iranian needs. I think that people really don't understand how much more repressive the regime became in Iran over the last few years. Somebody talked earlier about oil wealth. Iran doesn't have oil wealth. It has remarkably low oil earnings per capita, and that's the measure, not the total income. Mm-hmm. It has basically has to import gasoline. It has to import food. It's mismanaged agriculture, the state industries, the whole lives of Iranians on an ordinary economic level. For now, really, since the fall of the Shah, and he fell in part because of a serious economic recession. So when you talk about the forces at work here, is President Obama certainly different from George Bush as an image? Yes. Is that what triggered Iran? Definitely not.
How far do you think that influence can carry then?
I think the problem will depend on what we negotiate over and how well we negotiate. When it comes to real interests, people don't go with personality. They go with reality.
Anthony Cordesman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Rami Kouri, as always, thank you.
My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jack Beatty. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.